Wir begrüßen Sie ganz herzlich zum zweiten Tag des Eröffnungsprogramms des Projektes Wohnungsfrage am Haus der Kultur und der Welt. Wohnungsfrage ist im Kern eine Ausstellung. Zu dieser Ausstellung gehört dieses Eröffnungsprogramm. Zu dieser Ausstellung gehört eine Publikationsreihe mit 12 Büchern, die am Kiosk im Eingangsbereich auch einzusehen ist. Und zu der Ausstellung gehört eine Akademie und ein intensives Begleitprogramm in den nächsten Wochen und Tagen. Ich stehe hier mit mir dreien der vier Kuratorinnen des Projektes, Wilfried Kühn, mein Name ist Jesko Fetzer und Nikolaus Hirsch. Die vierte und wichtigste Kuratorin, Hila Pelek, kann, weil sie vor ein paar Tagen ein Kind bekommen hat, leider nicht hier sein heute. Wohnungsfrage ist ein Thema, das vor 2,5 Jahren, als wir die Gelegenheit bekommen hatten, diese Ausstellung hier anzufangen zu konzipieren, schon ein großes Thema war. Weltweit, in den Metropolen, aber auch im ländlichen Raum, war das Scheitern einer Wohnungspolitik des Neoliberalismus intensiv zu beobachten. Aber auch in den Metropolen des Nordens, auch in Berlin, der Stadt, in der wir leben, ist diese Frage angekommen. Auch vor 2,5 Jahren schon haben sich viele Initiativen aus dem politischen Spektrum, viele Künstlerinnen und Künstler, viele Architektinnen, aber auch Wissenschaftler, Forscherinnen, dem Thema befasst und versucht, die Veränderungsprozesse zu begreifen, die Problematik der sich verschärfenden Wohnungssituation zu erfassen und Gegenstrategien zu entwickeln. Inzwischen hat das Thema sich dramatisch verschärft. In Berlin können wir Preissteigerungen, Mietsteigerungen, aber auch Segregationsbewegungen beobachten, die das Maß sozialen Anstands überschritten haben. Und es haben sich noch mehr Initiativen und Praktiken entwickelt. Die Ausstellung hat die Möglichkeit, die das Haus der Kultur in der Welt bieten kann, versucht ernst zu nehmen, diesen Initiativen, diesen Diskursen, diesen künstlerischen, architektonischen Praxen zur Seite zu stehen und ein Projekt zu entwickeln, was im kulturellen Kontext die Frage nochmal aus einer etwas anderen Perspektive beleuchtet. Deswegen haben wir nicht die Notwendigkeit verspürt, hier heute und in der Ausstellung auf die Dringlichkeit detailliert hinzuweisen, die Fakten zusammenzustellen, wie die Situation besteht, sondern eher versucht, bestimmte Wege aufzuzeigen, bestimmte Möglichkeiten, Alternativen anzudiskutieren oder gar entwickeln zu lassen. Und wir sind sehr dankbar, dass wir nicht nur das Haus der Kulturen, sondern auch viele Künstlerinnen, Architekten, aber auch Initiativen und Forscherinnen gefunden haben, die diesen offenen Prozess in den letzten Jahren mit uns gegangen sind, um zu dieser Ausstellung und diesem Programm hier zu kommen. Die Wohnungsfrage, wie wir sie heute, mit der wir heute konfrontiert sind, hat für uns mit zwei Phänomenen zu tun. Das erste, das Offensichtliche, ist die Kommodifizierung des Wohnungswesens, die Reduktion des Wohnens auf ein immobilienwirtschaftliches Problem. Dass das Wohnen über die eigene Wohnung, über das Schlafen und Essen hinaus eine soziale Frage ist, wurde dabei systematisch sträflich übersehen. Und die Städte, die Kommunen, aber auch die Planer und Architekten haben die Frage der Bereitstellung des Wohnraums den Bauherren, und das waren in der Regel Immobilienkonzerne bzw. private Bauherren, überlassen. Hier eine andere Argumentation, eine andere Denkrichtung wieder aufzugreifen, auch im Sinne einer Tradition der Architekturgeschichte, die als moderne Architekturgeschichte eigentlich eine Architektur des Wohnens war, mit dem Versuch, über das Wohnen auch eine andere Gesellschaft zu entwickeln, diesen Anknüpfungspunkt aufzusuchen. Es ist ein Anliegen dieser Ausstellung, im vollen Bewusstsein, dass wir die heroische Perspektive der Moderne im Zusammenhang mit einer Gesellschaft, die in einer sozialdemokratischen Logik die Wohnungsversorgung entwickelt, dass wir diese Perspektive nicht mehr so einnehmen können. Der zweite Punkt, der angedeutet ist, ist eine wachsende Distanz zwischen Architektur als kultureller, aber auch sozialer Praxis von der Frage des Wohnens. Die Verknüpfung ist historisch evident. Dieses Wohnen, das wir heute kennen, ist auch ein architektonisches Projekt. Aber die Entfernung zwischen den Akteuren im Feld der Kultur und der sozialen Praxis und dem Wohnungswesen als wirtschaftliche Praxis hat ein bedrohliches Ausmaß angenommen. Um hier eine andere Perspektive aufzumachen, haben wir versucht, die Frage nach den Akteuren in dem Prozess des Wohnungswesens zu stellen. Und die Ausstellung, und das ist vielleicht ein Spezifika, was den Blick in die Ausstellung als Ausgangspunkt auch strukturieren und leiten kann, ein Spezifika, dass wir versucht haben, andere soziale Akteure in den Prozess einzubringen. Und wir haben diese Ausstellung angefangen zu entwickeln, gemeinsam mit Initiativen, politischen, lokalen Initiativen, die als Experten des Wohnens eine notwendige Ergänzung, wenn ich sozusagen auch eine gänzlich andere Perspektive einnehmen können als die wohlmeinenden Architekten, Die ahnungslosen und wohlmeinenden Stadtplaner, die Städte mit ihren Versorgungsprogrammen, die vor 50, 60, 40 Jahren nach numerischen Vorgaben entwickelt wurden, und natürlich den Wohnungsbaugesellschaften und Bauträgern, die eine ganz eigene Logik des Bauens, des Finanzierens und des Wiederverkaufens von Wohnungen entwickelt haben, die mit den wesentlichen Fragen des Wohnens wenig zu tun haben. Wir haben diese Gruppen haben wir adressiert, nicht als Opfer von Wohnungsnot, nicht als Individuen mit persönlichen Träumen und Wünschen, die hier erfüllt werden sollen, sondern als politisch aktive Player, die eine Haltung, eine Perspektive entwickelt haben, die wir als Ausgangspunkte für eine Diskussion der Ausstellung und ganz konkret als Ausgangspunkt für die Zusammenarbeit mit international aktiven Architekten für 4 1:1-Modelle in der Ausstellung ausgesucht haben. Wir hoffen darüber, die bestehenden Debatten, die Ansätze, die Fragestellungen, auch die Konflikte, die bestehen, zu unterstützen bzw. sie anzureichern, um eine Perspektive, wie sie vielleicht ein kultureller Raum wie das Haus der Kulturen auch eröffnen kann.
Die 1:1-Modelle stehen gewissermaßen im Mittelpunkt dieser Ausstellung. Die 1:1-Modelle, die dieser Verknüpfung von Initiativen mit internationalen Architekten entsprungen sind, die sich entwickelt haben in der Zusammenarbeit. Sie bilden die 4 großen Interventionen, die wir beauftragt haben und die gewissermaßen ein Architekturmodell im komplexeren Sinn sind, weil sie nicht nur ein 1:1-Modell physisch sind, sondern auch den Prozess des Werdens von Architektur im Zusammenspiel zwischen Auftraggeber, Nutzer und Architekten vollzogen haben und vollziehen und auch sichtbar machen, zusammen mit einer jeweiligen Publikation, die zu diesen 4 Modellen jeweils erschienen ist und von der jeweiligen Initiative zusammen mit dem Architekten des Modells herausgegeben und vorbereitet wurde. Und wir haben ja auch gestern 2 und heute 2 dieser Initiativen und der jeweiligen Architekten hier mit einem längeren Beitrag und einer längeren Diskussion im Programm, weil wir denken, dass genau das Relationale, also das Zusammenspiel und auch das bis hin zum konfliktreichen Zusammenwirken zwischen Architekten und gesellschaftlichen Gruppenvertretern, Benutzern von Raum eigentlich das entscheidende Kriterium dafür ist, Architektur entstehen zu lassen. Und weitet sich diese Idee des 1:1 dann auch in der Ausstellung weiter aus? 1:1 heißt für uns nicht nur physisch 1:1 im Sinne eines großen, lebensgroßen, lebensechten Modells, sondern es heißt auch 1:1 im Sinne einer Direktheit, einer Konfrontation 1:1 mit Themen und mit Dokumenten, die das Wohnen und die Wohnungsfrage historisch und aktuell beleuchten. Wir haben also historische Arbeiten über historische Phänomene wie Saal in Portugal, wie Kibbutzim in Israel, wie die Mikrobrigaden in Kuba, genauso im Programm, aber auch in Verbindung mit künstlerischen Interventionen jeweils und nicht als reine Historikerarbeit. Wir arbeiten von Künstlern wie Amy Siegel oder Martha Rosler oder Angelika Levy, die in zeitgenössischer Form sich mit dem Thema auseinandersetzen und Arbeiten zwischen Aktivismus und Kunst schaffen, die nicht so eindeutig zuzuordnen sind einer Sphäre und eben auch hier wieder das relationale Moment betonen. Die Ausstellung insgesamt ist keine klassische Kunstausstellung, sie ist aber auch keine klassische Architekturausstellung, wenn man überhaupt von so klassischen Formaten sprechen kann. Sie passt daher natürlich ins HKW. Sie macht den Versuch, Raum als wahrnehmbares, wirkliches, physisches in die Ausstellung zu bringen, als etwas, was der Besucher 1:1 auch selber erleben kann. Und wir denken, dass in der Erweiterung dieser Ausstellung hinein in das Publikationsprogramm und in das Programm, was wir heute und gestern hier erarbeitet haben und zusammen erleben, tatsächlich auch wichtig ist als Ausstellungserfahrung, als erweiterte Ausstellungserfahrung und auch wichtig ist als Teilnahme an dieser Ausstellung. Insofern freuen wir uns über die zahlreiche Teilnahme und Nikolaus Hirsch wird jetzt noch einen Überblick geben über die Programmatik insgesamt und den Ablauf des heutigen Tages.
Ja, danke Wilfried. Ja, wie bereits gesagt wurde, sehen wir die Ausstellung komplementär zu den anderen Formaten, die wir entwickelt haben. Sprich die Publikationsreihe, die auch eine Art erweiterte Ausstellung ist, mit Beiträgen, die für uns historisch relevant waren, wie Ausstellungen, proletarische Bauausstellungen oder das Wachsende Haus zum Beispiel. Dann auch Künstlerarbeiten wie Amy Siegel, über die wir gestern gesprochen haben. Und eine Akademie unter der Leitung von Reinhard Martin, die auch ganz spezifisch Themen untersuchen wird, diskutieren wird, die mit der Wohnungsfrage in Verbindung stehen. Und eben als Erweiterung der Ausstellung diese beiden Eröffnungstage, die uns Gelegenheit bieten, einige der Installationen hier, einige der Arbeiten genauer zu diskutieren, auch eine Plattform zu bieten für die Beteiligten. Und zum anderen haben wir auch einige Experten eingeladen, die in den nächsten Tagen hier in der Akademie tätig sein werden, die wir sozusagen hier so als Schnittstelle zur Ausstellung auch zu Wort kommen lassen. Und ähnlich wie der Rhythmus des gestrigen Tages haben wir drei Slots mit jeweils einer halbstündigen Pause, sofern sich die Beteiligten an die zeitlichen Vorgaben halten, worum ich natürlich bete an dieser Stelle. Wir fangen an mit David Madden, gefolgt von Martha Rosler. Da sind wir leider auf ein Livestreaming angewiesen, da Martha krank ist. Ich hoffe, die technische Verbindung wird mitmachen nach New York. Gefolgt von einer Präsentation eines der 1:1-Modelle von Dogma und Realism Working Group. Dann wird es eine Pause geben. Dann wird die auch sehr interessante historische Arbeit über das Kibbutz Communal by Commune präsentiert werden von Gaia Bar-Or und Zvi Evrat, gefolgt von einem kommentierten Filmscreening von Delphim Sado, der die Geschichte von Saal, dieser postrevolutionären Wohnungsbaugeschichte in Portugal, uns näher bringen wird. Dann werden wir eine Pause haben, beziehungsweise vor der Pause noch natürlich nicht zu vergessen, ganz wichtig, die Diskussion zwischen Assemble und Stille Straße, das zweite 1:1-Modell, das wir heute sehen werden. Dann kommt eine Pause und noch zwei Vorträge am Abend, einmal von Andrew Hirscher, ich glaube gerade das auch eine sehr relevante Diskussion im Zuge der Flüchtlingsthematik derzeit in Deutschland. Er wird über Unterbringung von Flüchtlingen primär in den Camps in Jordanien und Syrien und der Türkei sprechen, aber durchaus auch Bezüge herstellen zu der Situation jetzt in Deutschland. Gefolgt von dem letzten Beitrag für den heutigen Tag von Abdoumalik Simon, der eine Untersuchung aus seiner Perspektive darstellen wird, wo das, was man manchmal unter Formal Housing und Informal Housing bezeichnen kann, wird er untersuchen, kritisch darlegen, auch seine Sicht, inwieweit staatliche Wohnungsbaupolitik immer wieder scheitert aufgrund von falscher Annahmen über das, was Infrastrukturen eigentlich leisten können. Ich glaube, ein sehr interessantes Programm für heute. Ich hoffe, dass Sie alle durchhalten. Und würde nun gerne David Madden begrüßen. Und bei der Gelegenheit werde ich ins Englische übergehen. It's a great pleasure to welcome you, David. Here, David Madden is an urban sociologist and assistant professor in sociology and the cities program at the London School of Economics. His teaching and research is focused on urban studies and social theory. And you will hear today a contribution on the question of the neighborhood, which I think is, when I remembered the previous day and discussions from yesterday, the neighborhood is kind of big unknown. Everybody refers to it, but there's very little discussion or understanding whether this is a natural given or a construction or what else. And David is currently finishing a book co-authored with Peter Marcuse on housing politics and working on another project that examines public housing and urban restructuring in New York and London. And David has, before teaching at the LSE, has taught at Columbia University in New York and Bard College. He holds also a PhD from Columbia University and is a member of the editorial board of the journal City. Please give a warm welcome to David Madden.
Thank you very much. If you want to hear my thoughts on the concept of neighborhood, actually, you can read my contribution to the book. In fact, I'm going to be talking about inequality and commodification in housing, which maybe during the discussion period we can relate this to the question of the neighborhood. But I wanted to talk about some general keywords for understanding the housing question today, which I think we can pose as such. In a very general and basic way, what does it mean to dwell in a commodified world? What is it that produces our commodified housing system? And what does it mean to live within it? And as well, how can we change it? So I'm going to start with two snapshots from the housing process in action in New York City. On January 16th, 2015, a limited liability corporation named P8990 bought a single apartment in Midtown Manhattan for $1,471,452.77. The name of the actual buyer was kept secret, as are the identities of those who control the array of shell companies from around the world that own much of the rest of the building. Who they are hardly matters, as the luxury condominium that it tops, which has been branded as 157, will not be a particularly sociable environment. Chances are that none of the building's 92 units will be their owner's sole residence. In fact, most of the apartments in 157 will remain empty. They'll be held as investments or as vanity homes for people who do not lack places to dwell. The building is not so much high-rise housing as it is global wealth congealed into tower form. As 157 was being constructed across town in Bushwick, Brooklyn, residents of a vinyl-sided tenement at 98 Linden Street saw their home being destroyed. Carlos Calero and five family members pay $706 per month for apartment 1L in this building, a rent-stabilized two-bedroom space where they've lived for 20 years alongside friends and relatives. In 2012, the building was purchased in the name of Linden Ventures, LLC, and on the morning of June 4th, 2013, the new owners allegedly hired a contractor to take a sledgehammer to the family's kitchen, bathroom, and floors. The apartment was left in ruins, and a campaign of harassment followed. According to New York City's Tenant Protection Unit, the landlord's purposeful destruction of their own building was part of an effort to drive out the Caleros and raise the rent, a strategy that they have used in properties throughout the gentrifying Brooklyn neighborhoods of Bushwick, Williamsburg, and Greenpoint. The overproduction of luxury housing units and the destruction of affordable housing is occurring in the context of what most observers consider to be housing crisis in New York City. Since the year 2000, average rental costs have soared by 75%, while at the same time salaries have only gone up by 34%. More than half of the city is considered to be rent burdened, meaning they spend more than 30% of their income in rent. In recent years, homelessness, eviction, and displacement have been soaring. So we need to ask, what is it that connects all of these different phenomena? What is it that connects the overproduction of luxury housing and the destruction of affordable housing? In every corner of New York City, real estate is attacking housing. In some places, the weapon is the blue glass or weathering steel that clads luxury towers. Elsewhere, it is the drywall, padlocks, or sheets used to divide apartments into tiny, fire-prone warrens. Sometimes the tactic is tenant harassment. Other times, it is the state's power of eminent domain drafted into service for developers. These are all perverse manifestations of the same basic phenomenon, the subordination of the social use of housing to its economic value. And the term that social scientists and social critics use for this process is commodification. And what I want to communicate today is that in the current era, commodification of housing is occurring on a new scale, in fact, a historically unprecedented scale. And it is this hyper-commodification that is at the root of housing problems today. Now, we talked a bit about this yesterday, and I want to be clear that the housing system on its own does not cause economic and social inequality. Inequality has deeper roots than just the housing system. But housing is indeed one of the sectors where inequality becomes visible. And the housing system does have the capacity to shape the experience of inequality. So housing could, in principle, ameliorate the consequences of inequality, or it could amplify its effects. And I would argue, along with many urban researchers, that the more that housing is commodified, the more does it worsen the effects of inequality. That is the essence of the housing problem today. So I'm going to develop this argument here and touch upon some key terms in reference to the housing process and the housing system in largely New York City and to a lesser extent London. But I want to be clear that inequality and commodification are global problems. Across the world, we see those who exploit housing for profit coming into conflict with those who seek to use it merely for inhabiting. What is happening in New York and London is happening across the world. It takes different forms in different places, so that the form of the housing problem in New York is different than in the foreclosed suburbs of the American Southwest, the bulldozed shacklands of South Africa, the privatized council blocks of Great Britain, or the demolished favelas of Brazil. But they have a common root. They can often be traced to common actors, and they can perhaps be politicized and addressed using a common global strategy. So let's talk a bit about commodification. What is it? Very briefly, commodification is the process by which the economic value of a thing comes to overshadow or obliterate all of its other dimensions. It's an old idea in sociology and in social theory. And the point is that products created for the purpose of exchange are valuable because they're useful, but also because they can be sold on the market. Now, the usefulness of housing is that it can be lived in. And since housing can be lived in an infinite number of ways, its usefulness is, in principle, infinite. But as a bearer of value, it is a mere quantum, a stand-in for a sum of money like any other. When we say that housing is subject to commodification, we say that it is undergoing this process whereby its existence as an investment is coming to dominate all the other claims upon it. So its economic dimension takes precedent over all of these other dimensions to it, that claims to housing that could be based upon right, need, sentiment, tradition, legal precedent, cultural habit, or the ethical and effective significance of the home. Today, it might be difficult to conceive of a housing system that is not ruled by the commodity form. But it's important to realize that commodification is a variable. It expands, it contracts, it changes. And in the history of human settlements, the commodity treatment of dwelling space is relatively new. So before the rise of industrial capitalism, housing was not an independent sector. Rather, it was subsumed within larger social and economic relations, and it was really an outgrowth of the organization of labor. So housing had no economic value in and of itself. It was valuable because of the labor that occurred within it and within the estates that people lived. So when peasants were tied to the land, housing and work together formed the feudal system to which they were yoked. The historical precondition for the commodification of land and of housing was the privatization of the commons. Before land and housing could become exchangeable sources of privately appropriated profit, ancient systems of communal regulation had to be swept away and traditional tenures had to be destroyed. Now, the classic example of this process is the enclosure movement in early modern England. In a sequence lasting centuries, common land was fenced off and claimed by individual landowners. This process led to masses of floating, dispossessed people migrating to cities where they eventually became industrial laborers. Enclosure was a violent and complicated process that laid the groundwork for the eventual commodification of land on a planetary scale. And what was accomplished in early modern Europe by an alliance of the landed aristocracy, large manufacturers, and early modern financiers was brought to the rest of the world through colonialism. And in the process, countless pre-colonial systems of land tenure were destroyed. But even in early commercial society, even after enclosure and empire had transformed land ownership across the globe, housing still largely remained an outgrowth of the organization of work rather than a commodity in its own right. And you can see this in the history of early capitalist housing, where work and housing are connected through company towns and other forms. It's only as industrial capitalism matures that housing becomes disembedded from the circuits of production to become a direct bearer of value in itself. In the 19th century, major cities become home to an industrial proletariat no longer housed in or chained to their place of work. And it's only now, for the first time, that majorities of people looked to the open market to secure their place of residence. Only with the rise of industrial urbanized capitalism could cash payment become the only nexus between house and householder. These were the conditions that enabled the commodification of housing. So when Engels was surveying the contours of the housing question in the industrial slums of Manchester and London, he was describing the impact of the commodification of residence in a laissez-faire commodified world. And as we know, this form of housing proved to be a social disaster. And so in response, many countries sought to ameliorate its greatest harms by decommodifying housing to various degrees. Regulations and building standards were enacted. Municipal or national governments became directly involved in the housing process. The rise of social housing is a complex history that I'm not going to get into, but the important point is to understand that starting with the late 19th and early 20th century, there was this broad movement to rein in commodification. And this took, took different places, took different shapes in different places. But the post-war housing landscape in many countries was marked by this drive towards decommodification. There was this broad effort to limit its effects. And even in the U.S., which never had a particularly strong social housing sector by European standards, from the 1920s onward, the housing system was strongly shaped by the state, and it remains so to this very day. So suburban landscapes like that of Levittown, which are so iconic in the American imagination, as symbols of autonomy and of independence and independent living, they depended upon state funds for infrastructure and finance, even as these were filtered through market mechanisms. So by the post-war period, in the U.S. and Europe and many other parts of the world, housing had a central place in the Fordist Keynesian economic system. Housing was the site that organized the mass consumption that underpinned mass production. It's really not until the last few decades of the 20th century that housing becomes a liquid asset and real estate becomes a global corporate behemoth. So if the shape that commodification takes it changes over time, if commodification expands and contracts, today we are unlucky enough to be living through a period of unprecedented expansion. In today's transnational, digitally enhanced market, housing is becoming ever less an infrastructure for living and ever more an instrument for financial accumulation. Hypercommodification today occurs at a time when the place of housing within the global economy is changing. It is no longer the key point for state intervention to organize consumption. Now housing is a strategic site for direct profit accumulation. And we really do need to recognize that this situation is historically unprecedented. And I think we can understand this situation by looking at three mutually reinforcing and interlocking processes that contribute to the hyper-commodification of housing today. Again, these take different forms in different places, and some cities and some countries have managed to resist these processes to a greater or lesser extent. But in some form, they're reshaping the housing system globally. So the first dimension of hyper-commodification of housing today is deregulation. This is the contemporary counterpart to enclosure. So in many countries, but especially the neoliberal heartlands of the US and the UK, there's been a steady trend towards the removal of regulations, customs, and rules governing residential financial arrangements. This process has not meant the subtraction of the state from real estate markets, so much as rewriting the rules to make real estate more of a liquid commodity. The most obvious examples are in home finance. So over the past few decades, regulations surrounding mortgage lending were fatally weakened in the U.S., Britain, and many other countries, with consequences that were apparent to all of us. Pillars of financial regulation that constrained the mortgage market were gutted. Usury controls were eliminated. Risk management was outsourced to ratings agencies. exotic and risky finance mechanisms were introduced and often sold to people who would have qualified for less expensive and less risky traditional mortgages. The regulatory powers of the state that could have prevented these predatory loans were curtailed. So home finance is a clear example of deregulation in action, but many aspects of Western housing systems were deregulated. Many other aspects were deregulated as well. So we heard a bit about the counterpart to the story in Berlin yesterday, but in New York City, rent regulation regimes have been completely overthrown. Between 1981 and 2011, the number of rent-controlled apartments in New York has plummeted from more than 285,000 to less than 39,000. The regulated share of the rental market fell from more than 62% to 47%, and the power of the regulations that that do persist has been lessened. At the same time, in the US and the UK, deregulation has brought a wave of privatization to publicly owned or controlled housing. So in the US, public housing is in full retreat. Since the 1990s, more than 260,000 public housing units across the US were either sold off to private owners or demolished in order to sell off the land beneath them. The situation is even grimmer in Britain, where public housing represented a much larger piece of the housing sector. Since 1981, nearly 3 million council houses have been sold or transferred. And we see this story repeated again and again across the world. In post-socialist countries, the privatization of housing since 1989 has probably constituted the largest transfer of property rights in history. So the islands of partial decommodification that developed in the post-war period have been eroded. The second dimension of hypercommodification is what's called financialization. So financialization is, like commodification, financialization is a sort of generic term within social science to describe industries where profit accumulation is achieved through finance, through the servicing and exchanging of money and debt, rather than through production. And we can see financialization shaping the housing system at so many different levels. Again, the mortgage market provides a good example. What was once a facilitating market became a tool for profit-making on its own. Over the past half century or so, home mortgages were transformed from an industry dominated by local lending to one dominated by corporate banking and digitally enhanced securitization. Financialization is leading to a transformation in the nature of landlordism as real estate merges with finance. So Wall Street and the City of London are the new landlords on the block. Between 2004 and 2008, private equity firms bought nearly 10% of the total number of rent-stabilized apartments in New York City. So there's been this massive transformation. This is a process that has only grown after the subprime mortgage crisis. So firms like Blackstone saw this crisis as an opportunity to begin purchasing cheap houses en masse. The growth of real estate investment trusts, or REITs, is a major indicator of the financialization of housing. So in the US, real estate investment trusts were created by congressional law in 1960. They spent their early years as mere tax shelters, but another act of Congress in 1986 gave them the right to take a more active role in operating and exploiting the buildings in their portfolios. Since then, they've grown exponentially, and real estate investment trusts now comprise the largest property owners in New York. They're, in the US alone, they're capitalized at more than $907 billion. And taken together, the global real estate securities market has been estimated to have a total market capitalization of more than $1.7 trillion US dollars. Which brings me to the third and final dimension of the hypercommodification of housing, which is globalization. And it seems as if globalization and housing can't really fit together all that easily. I mean, houses and real estate are fixed in space. But the real estate system today is increasingly dominated by economic networks that are global in scope. So housing markets are starting to become more responsive to global economic signals than to local ones. And you can see the consequences of this, again, across the world. In London especially, new apartment buildings are regularly advertised to foreign buyers abroad before they're advertised to any households in London. And at massive property fairs, such as the event in Cannes known as MIPIM, which maybe just concluded, housing is directly connected to global circuits of investment. So one elite real estate developer put it quite simply that luxury real estate is now the world's new currency. It's not that luxury real estate can be purchased with currency around the world. Now it is currency itself. So taken together, the deregulation, financialization, and globalization of housing have led to commodification on a new scale. And this is what I think lies at the heart of the housing crisis today. And this is why we need to pose the housing question today, is what does it mean to dwell in a hyper-commodified and unequal world? Obviously, its impact is quite uneven. So in some cities, we see the emergence of a so-called super prime real estate, like 157 that I mentioned earlier, or the Time Warner Center pictured here. Luxury real estate functions like a reserve currency, so it serves merely as an investment tool. But interestingly, it still receives massive amounts of public subsidies. 157 received more than $65 million in public funds. And the trickle-down benefits of these subsidies have been greatly exaggerated. Some people say, well, you know, this money will lead to investment in other areas of the housing system, or we can see that luxury development is financing affordable housing. But for the most part, this is not occurring at any sort of significant scale. Billionaires Row in New York City has so far contributed a grand total of 89 affordable apartments, and 157 itself financed merely 66 homes at a cost of $905,000 per unit. New York's independent budget office calculated that a grant of that size in the hands of a nonprofit housing organization could have built at $179,000 per unit 370 apartments. So on the one hand, we have the emergence of this super prime real estate that is functioning as a global reserve currency. But at the same time, in less elite and exclusive parts of the housing sector, we see the impact of hyper-commodification is quite brutal. So deregulation has not translated into the affordable paradise that its promoters predicted. Instead, it has allowed powerful real estate actors to monopolize more housing. So cities like New York and London that have seen huge building booms in recent decades have not seen corresponding drops in housing costs. One international study of deregulation found that demand pressures stemming from deregulation may have translated into an increase of housing prices by some 30%. So across New York, when investors purchase apartment buildings, tenants start worrying. Private equity firms often make for ruthlessly profit-seeking landlords, and they often institute rent increases, and when that's not possible, under maintenance, milking existing leases until the buildings can be sold or redeveloped. So these four buildings in the Bronx were part of a portfolio of thousands of units that were purchased by a consortium of private equity firms. And according to tenant groups, once they were in the hands of these firms, they were systematically under-maintained. Heat and hot water was cut off. Tenants were harassed, threatened with evictions. And the buildings accrued hundreds of code violations and complaints. During this whole time, rents were being raised. And so some firms specialize in fraudulent activities or nearly fraudulent activities in order to get rent-stabilized tenants out of these new units. It's a practice that housing activists in Vancouver have dubbed rent-eviction, so using the process of renovation as a way to end lower rent tendencies. Here's another building in the Bronx, which was purchased by an investment firm in 2007. And the other thing about these new real estate actors is that not only do they lead to increases in risk and insecurity and instability for the tenants who live in their buildings, but they themselves are often quite risky. And this building was purchased by an investment firm, then went into foreclosure, purchased by another firm, and starts cycling through all of these different owners, falling into an ever worse state of repair. So in a hyper-commodified housing system, even when buildings fail to turn a profit, there's no exit from the financialized circuit. They're simply bought up and reinserted, setting the stage for a repeat of the entire ordeal. We can see that the growth of predatory equity in rental housing has accelerated processes of gentrification and displacement. So you can take the case here of Ji Qingzheng, who is a founding member of New York's Chinatown Tenants Union and a former garment worker in her 60s. She lived for years in this building at 61 Delancey Street in Manhattan's Lower East Side in a rent-stabilized unit. According to reports, when an investment company named Madison Capital bought her building, it determined that what she saw as her longtime affordable home was in fact an underperforming asset that needed to be repositioned to garner the six-fold rent increases that the market demanded in the name of efficiency. So Madison Capital, again, according to reports, did what any rational profit-maximizing actor would do and began a campaign of harassment, cutting the heat, leaving damage unrepaired, and gratuitously calling the police on tenants. And again, the sort of argument that some economists and some housing commentators use is that all this is necessary in order to make the housing market more efficient. But I think we really need to challenge this concept of efficiency and ask, efficient for what? Efficient for whom? I think buying buildings like this and having your business plan predicated on the idea that you'll be evicting your tenants is not making the market more efficient. It's just wringing more money from people who cannot afford it. I also think we need to recognize that the recommodification of real estate is the main driver of gentrification today. So a lot of people look at places like the Lower East Side in New York or at Bushwick, which I mentioned earlier, and look at changing retail scapes and new bars and restaurants. But these are really not driving the process. These are symptoms. The recommodification of housing is the essence of the process, and the rise of these bigger, more ruthless new real estate actors who are coming to dominate the scene. Now, for these new real estate actors, it's clear that gentrification is the business plan. So when we talk about neighborhood development today and housing development today, and we ask, well, you know, can we have some sort of development without gentrification? As long as this business plan prevails, then we cannot. So firms purchase buildings on the assumption that rents can be doubled, tripled, or more. Their loans can only be repaid if the rent is raised, maintenance is skipped, and or rent-regulated tenants are displaced. This diagram is from a neighborhood investment fund in New York who really puts the matter quite straightforwardly. They say, your returns are generated through rent minus expenses equals profit, a strategy that they say, quote, focuses on acquiring properties with current rental income in place and the ability to increase that income over time. So the only way this strategy can work is if tenants are displaced, if rents are raised, if gentrification proceeds. Obviously, smaller landlords face similar calculations, but smaller landlords are not necessarily subject to the same demands of shareholders. At the same time, I don't think we should romanticize small-time landlords. I mean, they can provide some people with some modicum of housing affordability, but in insecure form, because tenants have no dependable and defensible claim to maintaining their place. And it shouldn't be the case that in order to have affordable housing, you need to be lucky enough to have an essentially irrational landlord. Commodification is also a self-reproducing process. So it operates simultaneously at different scales. And I think the sort of problematic of commodification is how we can understand contemporary controversies over things like Airbnb, of subletting small rooms, subletting sofas, renting corners or sheds in your backyard. We see that commodification of the housing system at these large scales is leading to commodification at ever smaller scales. So people become independent housing entrepreneurs as a way to eke out a place in an unstable and expensive housing market. But this too gets absorbed into the broader logic of commodification. And in London, we already see the emergence of rent-to-rent entrepreneurs who specialize in renting apartments and then immediately subletting them for more. No doubt there are some canny financial innovators who are already working on the securitization of rent-to-rent housing or the pooling of Airbnb streams. So again, what does it mean to dwell in a hyper-commodified world? It means alienation, insecurity for those at the bottom of the economic structure, while at the top it means the proliferation of of this real estate that is not housing. Around the world, we see those seeking to turn houses into liquid assets are creating problems for those who merely want to live in them. Our housing system is moving towards an unequal system that resembles our broader unequal economic structures. So the 1% live in antisocial citadels, while the rest of us face insecurity and must work ever more hours to pay higher rents or mortgages. So again, we can say that when housing becomes commodified, when this process of commodification is pushed farther and farther than any of its previous limits, and when this happens under conditions of inequality, we see that the social violence of the economic structure is amplified in dwelling space. So this means that some people will have multiple million-dollar penthouses, but it also means that others will be forced into uninhabitable dwelling spaces. Some people will be forced to live in sheds. Some people will be packed with dozens of others into single rooms. This is not the housing system failing to work. This is what the current housing system looks like in action. And so we really need to think about what decommodification can look like in the contemporary era. I mean, commodification is not the default state that housing adopts. It is not a traditional state in which we find the housing system. It is relatively new. It depends upon state action. Its emergence is uneven. In essence, commodified housing is something that is made, so therefore it can be unmade. The basic problem with making housing a commodity is that, as such, living space will be distributed based on the ability to pay and provided to the extent that it produces a profit. But the ability to pay is unequal, while the need for a place to live is universal. So this is the fundamental disconnect. And ultimately, it doesn't actually matter how many actors and institutions treat housing as a globally circulating liquid commodity, because in the end, housing can never actually be a fully liquid exchangeable good. Its usefulness, and indeed a portion of its monetary value, comes from its place within communities that emerge over time. They require continuity and stability. Wrenching housing out of its context so that it can circulate as a value form on the global scale obliterates this social dimension. We should not, though, blame all of this on greed. I think that the sort of dominant discourse in a lot of places is that we need to get greed out of the housing system. But I think greed is a misdiagnosis. The problem is the rules of the game that currently reign. So the solution to the housing problem is not moralism, but installing a different structural logic. We need to reimagine decommodified housing and defend and expand the decommodified housing spaces that resist the dominant consensus. So we need to defend and expand public housing. We need to defend and expand rent control, alternative tenures. We need to go into the streets to contest the market consensus. And one of the sort of things about the fact that commodification of housing is quite recent is that we can look to these projects in the past, for example. So when people say that there's no other way to finance housing, there's no other way to organize the housing system than the way in which it's organized today, we can see that that's not the case. And there are examples in this city, there are examples in London and in New York and cities across the world of decommodified housing or partially decommodified housing. And the dominant argument is that these have been failures, but I really think it's important for us as researchers, as architects, as activists, as people who live in housing to point to the fact that it's not the case. Decommodified housing can work quite well, and we can see concrete examples everywhere we go. So a proper understanding of housing struggles today, I think, requires an account of its commodification, of this historically unprecedented condition of hyper-commodification. But making progress on housing problems today requires developing concrete decommodified alternatives to it. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David, for this incredibly detailed insight also into the commodification of housing, mainly on the with the example of New York City. I think that the logic was quite apparent that this is really a system that has been made. It's not a natural given, something we might forget after living around 20 years in neoliberalism or more. People tend to think that this is nature, almost. In the end, you raised the question, well, how can it be, can the system that has been made, how can it be unmade? And you hinted at some examples. Maybe you can give some, or without going too much into detail, because the system, and this was also something that was shown yesterday by André Holm, it's the housing system, as you called it, also in reference to Reinhold Martin's paper for the Academy. It seems so big, so overwhelming. What can be done?
What can be done? Well, I think it is important to talk about the housing system and to understand these issues on a structural level. But one of the reasons that people tend to be suspicious of talk about structures and systems is that it does make problems seem intractable, and it does make it seem as if systems have some sort of autonomous life of their own, and that's not the case. Systems, as we've said, that housing system developed in specific ways for specific reasons and can indeed be changed. I think it means that people who are trying to change the housing system need to develop particular kinds of strategies. So first, they need to really work to develop sites of intervention. And this can mean specific sites for sort of architectural or urbanist intervention, but also sites within the housing system. So contesting the rules governing the financial organizations that are so strong within these markets, contesting government policies, contesting zoning. I mean, the sort of collection of sites that are politicizable is in the housing problem is quite broad, but it requires concrete political work in order to make that apparent. And the other thing we need to do, I think, is generalize the housing problem. So often when housing struggles and housing problems and housing injustice are examined, they're examined as problems for people who are ill-housed. And so people talk about the sort of problem of living in terrible conditions or even the problem of not being able to afford housing. But I think we need to understand that the transformation of the housing system affects all of us. And there is, I think, potential for alliances between different spaces within this stratified system. So it's not only people who are living in terrible housing conditions who are sort of experiencing the brunt of housing problems. It's also middle-class people who are working longer than they would like, or who have to take jobs that they wouldn't otherwise want to have. It's a broad issue that really impacts everyone, and I think the more that this is understood, the more that there can be broad demands to change the housing system.
Does this imply a kind of withdrawal from the market logics?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that it clearly implies withdrawing from market logics, but also building alternative logics.
Or misusing them?
Sorry.
Or misusing these logics, partly?
I think the right strategy is to sort of raise general consciousness about what the commodification and marketization of housing has done. And I don't know, there's, to the extent that there are government policies aimed at helping people with their housing struggles these days, they do sort of follow market logics and work within market structures. And ultimately, I think this is a mistake. I mean, it means that the existence of social housing and of public housing is tied to this luxury housing sector. And I think rather than trying to sort of claw back a few crumbs from these market actors, it's better to think about how to transform the housing system so that the market actors are no longer the dominant forces.
Maybe there are questions from the audience who would like to open it up. Can't hear this one.
Thank you for the presentation, David. You begin by presenting the dichotomized condition of development of luxury housing and the destruction of affordable housing. I'm wondering, in that kind of, in the context of gentrifying neighborhoods, when you have the kind of juxtaposition in some cases of luxury housing or high-priced condominiums kind of superimposed against older vernacular architecture, how might that start to influence the social relationships between those groups that are now in these commodified, gentrified spaces and these kind of devalued spaces? What might be some of the psychosocial implications of the relationships between those two groups?
Yeah, thank you. That's a big question. And also an empirical question that really does depend upon local circumstances. I think in areas where working class and poor households have relatively secure housing, you will have a much different set of interactions with gentrifying neighbors than in places where the where working class or poor households are living in very insecure circumstances. But, I mean, this actually does get back to this issue of neighborhood to some extent, because I think that when we sort of think about the gentrification process, we do tend to sort of naturalize neighborhoods and understand them as these sort of monolithic entities, when it could very well be that all sorts of different communities and social networks and groups are sort of juxtaposed with one another in the same space, but not really acting as neighbors as such. So I mean, it will take different forms and in different places. But I mean, I think part of it also is in gentrifying neighborhoods, people tend to sort of, I don't know, imagine that the neighborhood itself has some set of interests. And I think this is also, you know, which gets partly to this issue of the sort of psychosocial dimension to all of this. And I really think we need to resist that way of framing the question as well. I mean, neighborhoods don't really have interests as such. They are synthetic creations, and we need to look at the conflicts that are present in most of these places. Another question?
Hello.
Yeah.
Here?
Oh, hi.
Hello, David. So thank you so much for your presentation. Actually, it was quite interesting that you suggested a path towards decommodification, but I would like to learn what you have to say regarding some guy who actually suggests another path, which is a path towards commodification. I mean, I'm talking about Hernando de Soto. So he argues, and actually your presentation was pretty much about the global north, right? And this guy has a solution for the global south. The question, what he poses is something quite simple. It's what if we give the extra legal people squatting settlements and so on and so forth extra legal rights to own the place where they live? And we could create immediately trillions of dollars of assets, and therefore explore some emancipatory potential of an asset, which is land and all that. So since these are apparently two completely different paths, how do you see it? So do you see that there is, or do you think there is, or there are two different paths, one for the global north and another for the global south, or something that we could make sense of as a global project?
No, thanks for that. I mean, I've mostly been talking about New York and London because these are the cities that I've been researching and writing about. But I do know that it's a sort of ever-recurring idea in housing studies that if you formalize land titles in the cities of the global south, or if you help people build their own housing that they then own, that this will sort of solve the housing problem in these areas. And I think we should be wary of this. I mean, it is in some ways not emancipating people from this structure of commodification, but including them within it. And it's also an idea that has floated in the cities of the global north as well. This idea of like, well, just, you know, give people property rights. I mean, some people use this argument to justify privatization of council housing in Britain. The same idea of like, well, people are living in their houses, just give them the rights to exchange it, and look at all this money that will just sort of appear out of nowhere. I think in practice this tends to bolster inequality and not necessarily to change it.
Follow up on this?
No.
So practically, what you were describing, and I agree, and thank you for your excellent presentation. I agree with you that this process of giving land titles to the global south does not really solve a problem, because quite often there is one big developer, not even that big, who comes and buys off this kind of from everyone the title, and then people just go somewhere else and squat another territory. Nice. But it is some kind of a form of expulsion and enclosure. And also the privatization of public and council housing we can see as a kind of a new level of enclosure, the similar like the with the thing that you started your presentation with, which was enclosure of common land in the UK.
Absolutely.
And it's, what is interesting, it's again happening for this, almost like at the beginning in the UK. So we are again like having UK as this front runner of the capitalism.
Well, it likes to see itself as on the cutting edge, so.
So, but is then the kind of, but then actually, can we at all think of that we can solve the problem of housing, hyper-commodified housing system without dismantling capitalism and the whole system of property?
This is also a good question and also a very old question. I don't want to open a hours or years long debate right now on it, but you're welcome. I think we can say that given our current political economic system, the housing problem will not be solved. But that doesn't mean we can't act on it. And it doesn't mean that we can't actually make the housing part of this broader system more humane. And it doesn't mean that the housing sector can't become a vehicle for broader social transformation as well. So while I do think we definitely need to think in structural terms, as I said, I think the danger with that is in thinking that we can't do anything until the structure as a whole has been changed.
If I may extend your question, I wonder if we talk about commodification, why should housing be the system that actually doesn't commodify? Because what we witness today is that everything is commodified. More and more, the so-called shared economy.
Yeah.
You mentioned Airbnb. I think there are thousands of others. So it seems as we wish for a kind of exemption here, which doesn't fit at all to what's happening outside there.
Yeah, well, and also the commodification, I mean, it's a very good point, and the commodification of one area contributes to the commodification of others. And so the more that health, the more that social security, the more that labor and all of these other areas of our political economic life are commodified, the more sort of momentum does the commodification process have. So why housing? I definitely don't think that housing is the only sector that needs to be decommodified. I think there are some things about housing that that make it a good place, perhaps, to start. For one, as I said, it is quite weird to have commodified housing historically, and housing as a set of structures doesn't actually lend itself very well to being traded as a global commodity. For another, it is just so fundamental and so universal that even by the sort of logic of market society, it doesn't really make sense. If you don't have housing, you can't actually participate in any other kind of market. You can't. It's a precondition for being an economic actor, rational on profit maximizing or not. And so I think for that reason, housing is a good place to start. But.
Thank you, David. It's really a fantastic contribution for just a thought. Thank you, David. We are now trying to connect to Martha Rosler. I get some signs here. I'm trying to read them. I need new glasses, maybe. Martha, hello.
Oh, hi. Can you hear?
I hear you. Do you hear me?
I hear you very well. You're very, very small.
Well, if you know how to make me bigger, I'm not sure. But but thank you so much for being available for us early morning in New York. First of all, we miss you so much here because you have contributed two wonderful, very important pieces to the Wohnungsfrage exhibition.